Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. And do we have a whopper of a program for you this evening? I fully expect us to cover, if not all the bases, then almost all the bases tonight, and we'll waste little time in getting right to it. Among the most despised criminals of all time is the man convicted of murdering Senator Robert Kennedy, gunning him down during the heart of a presidential campaign in the Ambassador Hotel in L.A. in June 1968. Sirhan has been behind bars ever since. He's appeared before the parole board in California 14 times, but has been denied each time. But there's a new wrinkle, and the word wrinkle doesn't begin to describe it. Fresh ballistics evidence, which strongly suggests that Sirhan could not possibly have killed Robert Kennedy because he was never close enough to have done what the physical evidence proves happened. If true, it raises larger and more disturbing questions, and we all know what those questions would be. Coming up in a few minutes, William Pepper, an internationally known attorney who is representing Sirhan, to tell us about the new twists in one of history's most notorious assassinations. And then switching gears for hours 2, 3, and 4, some of you may know Tom DeLonge as the lead singer, co-founder, and songwriter for a wildly popular band, Blink 182. But Tom's interests extend far beyond music. This year, he created a paranormal website, which he hopes will become sort of the central clearinghouse for all things ufological or paranormal. It's called Strange Times, strangetimes.com. We have a link on our website if you want to check it out. Tom has become something of an authority on our favorite topic, so I wanted to tap into his psyche and get a handle on how the next generation of ufologists look at the mysteries that are so central to our coast-to-coast interests, where this kind of research might be heading, and whether there's room for rock and roll and the paranormal to sort of mesh with high tech and resolve some of these questions once and for all. I've had the pleasure of speaking a couple of times with Tom, and I think you'll find him to be bright, engaging, and amazingly well-informed about the cases and issues that are so near and dear to our hearts. A couple of quick news items that deserve mention, however, tonight. CNN is reporting that North Korea's longtime leader, Kim Jong II, the embodiment of that reclusive state where his cult of personality is deeply entrenched, has died. Kim was believed to be 69 years old. Regarded as one of the world's most repressive leaders, Kim Jong II always cut a slightly bizarre figure. His diminutive stature and characteristically bouffant hair have been the subject of considerable ridicule, but the guy has atomic weapons, so his departure is nothing to laugh about, and it's not exactly clear who's going to succeed him or whether a shakeup or coup could be in the works. That's what the Associated Press is reporting. Also, the last convoy of U.S. troops to leave Iraq has entered Kuwait, nearly 9 years after the invasion that toppled Saddam Hussein. The final column of about 100 armored vehicles carrying 500 soldiers crossed the southern Iraqi desert overnight. At the peak of the operation there, of course, we have 170,000 U.S. troops on the ground in more than 500 bases in Iraq. Nearly 4,500 U.S. soldiers, tens of thousands of Iraqis died since the campaign began in 2003. The operation cost Washington nearly $1 trillion. That's the official estimate anyway. I have to think the real number is a lot higher than that. Remember that last-minute deal worked out to avoid a government shutdown? It's dead. CNN reporting tonight that House Speaker John Boehner said Sunday he opposes a temporary extension of the payroll tax cut, saying the two-month plan passed by the Senate is just kicking the can down the road. Boehner urged Congress to continue negotiations Monday to come up with a compromise that would extend the current payroll tax rate for a full year, as the Obama administration wants. I do want to mention the Knapp's News section of the Coast to Coast website tonight. Webmaster Tim Binall and I have put together our usual eclectic smattering of this and that, including a photo courtesy of NASA that is a perfect fit for the Christmas season. You'll see what I mean when you take a peek at it. Also there, a newspaper column by yours truly to mark the 40th anniversary of the act created to protect wild horses and burros. This week marks that 40th anniversary. Not exactly a happy anniversary, though. And a couple of other stories that we might have a chance to chat about through the course of the evening, if we get that chance. Coming up later, Tom DeLonge of Blink 182, and up next, attorney William Pepper to tell us why he thinks his client, Sirhan Sirhan, is an innocent patsy. Good stuff coming. I'm George Knapp, and I'll be right back with more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. William Francis Pepper is a barrister in the United Kingdom, but practices law here in the United States as well. His primary work is in international commercial law. He's represented governments in the Middle East, Africa, South America, and Asia. Today, though, he represents Sirhan Sirhan, the gunman convicted in the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy back in 1968. Mr. Pepper, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Can I ask you how it is you came to represent Sirhan Sirhan?
Well, after Sirhan's previous lawyer, Larry Teeter, died, people associated with the case, including his brother, started talking with me about the possibility of representing Sirhan. I had followed the case from the sidelines for a number of years and wasn't terribly knowledgeable about it. I had been involved in representing James Earl Ray and then the family of Martin Luther King Jr. Related to that assassination over many years. Martin King was a friend of mine during the last year of his life, so I became quite involved in that one after Ralph Abernathy asked me to go to the prison and interrogate Ray back in 1977. We eventually did that in 78. But so I had a passing familiarity with the with Bob Kennedy's assassination, and when I began to look at some of the evidence that had surfaced even back in 2005, it became clear to me that there were many questions related to that assassination, and I was not at all satisfied that they had been answered. I also noted that there had never really been a hearing on the merits of the case, because it had been mired in a procedural quagmire for all of those years. And so there never had really been an opportunity to have the facts as they were emerging put on the record and looked at. So having looked at those issues and that possibility, I decided to become involved and to explore the possibilities of a successful habeas petition.
Of course, you know that there's an incredible amount of skeptics about who really killed JFK. Of course, you mentioned representing James Earl Ray. I can see somebody saying, well, didn't any of these assassins kill the guy they were convicted or thought to have killed, that nobody killed anybody?
Well, I can't speak to the JFK assassination. I haven't done much of a look into that one. The assassination of Martin King, of course, I did. I spent better than a quarter of a century on. So we know what happened in that case. We held a trial. I represented the King family in a trial that lasted 30 days in Memphis, civil trial. Brought over 70 witnesses into the courtroom, and those witnesses laid out how and why Martin King was killed. You probably don't know anything about it. Media blacks out these kinds of cases when they start to get close to the bone. So they would leave the courtroom except when Coretta would testify or Andy Young or some of the notables. Other than that, when the hard evidence started being presented, they were conspicuously absent, and that case was never covered. So there's no question that there's skepticism across the country, because mainstream media perpetuates it, and we have to deal with that in these kinds of cases. You know, I mean, Carl Bernstein taught us back in 1978 that there are over 400 intelligence agents that are ensconced in various positions of all the major media organizations, both print and visual and audio. So we shouldn't be surprised that that these cases are not reported and that the people are skeptical because they only know what they read and what they're told.
Well, let's tell them your side of this one. What is the evidence that convinced you that Sirhan couldn't have done this? Make the case. You got about 2 million people listening to you right now.
Okay. Well, the case is and the evidence is spelled out, I think, quite clearly in the brief that we filed on the 21st of November. For the first time, we've had an opportunity to put forward all of the evidence with respect to the actual innocence of Sirhan, and that we were able to do that because there was a ruling in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Lee versus Lampert case that said that for the first time the law was made clear that in that jurisdiction that evidence of actual innocence overrides procedural defects. That had not been the case before, and that was why the state was able to keep the case on the procedural basis rather than letting the actual evidentiary facts come forward. So now with that ruling, the magistrate had to order that the state respond to facts of actual innocence, which they did, and then we filed the brief I just referred to, which is a matter now of public record, on the 21st of November. The brief sets forth it's a series of facts that relate to the case and to the actual innocence of Sirhan. First of all, there is the audio forensic testing that has been done of a tape recording that was made at the time of the shooting. And it's called the Brzezinski tape. It was made by a journalist who was in the vicinity of the shooting, and the technology had not been available until fairly recently for the deciphering of the sounds on that tape. And we go into a detailed examination with that is the result of a forensic analysis of the sounds on the shape of the tape, which pretty clearly indicates, and the expert concluded without any doubt, that 13 shots were fired on that evening. Sirhan's gun, of course, only held 8. That there were overlapping shots. Shots 3 and 4, 7 and 8, seemed to be overlapping. You know, the shots were so close together that they couldn't have been fired from a single gun. So there were it's an indication there were 2 guns fired. Post-firing vibrations that were capable of being analyzed by this technology indicated that shots were fired from 2 directions. Sirhan was east of the senator, and there were shots fired from east to west, which would have indicated shots from his gun. Bullets were fired from west to east, which is from behind the senator. So that it's quite clear from that forensic analysis that there were 2 shooters and there were 2 guns. There were 13 bullets fired.
Well, the witness had always said that Sirhan was in front of him, so if he was shot from behind, it couldn't have been Sirhan.
Well, that's the next point. We have statements from 12 witnesses that indicated that Sirhan was always in front of the senator, never behind him. And the senators, even if the senator turned, was shaking hands or finishing shaking hands with someone so that there was a slight angle, Sirhan was still in front of him. And the senator was shot. There were 4 bullets shot at the senator from behind. 2 of them were pressed right up against his coat, so there were powder burns on the jacket. The third one went through his was fired at about 1 to 2 inches, no more than 2 inches, behind his right ear, and that was the fatal bullet. The 4th shot went through a shoulder pad of his coat. All of these shots were fired at very close range from behind. Sirhan was in front, and the witnesses vary on how close he was in the front. He was the closest to someone said was about a foot and a half to two. Other people have said five and a half feet. So he was, but he was always in front. Then there were five witnesses whose statements we put forward that very clearly indicated that that Sirhan fired two shots from his pistol, and after he got off two shots, his hand was pinned to the steam table, and he continued robot-like to pull the trigger, but effectively lost control of the ability to aim his gun after the first two shots. So it makes no sense when four bullets were fired from the rear of the senator, and Sirhan only got was able to get at the most two shots off from the front that he could have ever killed the senator. So those witnesses, that audio tape indicates quite clearly that Sirhan couldn't have killed the senator. We go on from there to deal with the actual state of mind, the actual mental state of Sirhan. And Dr. Daniel Brown, we brought in from Harvard, who's an expert psychologist on hypnoprogramming and memory implantation, has worked with Sirhan over a period of 3 years. So we had a very extensive contact with him. Brown's declaration makes it quite clear that Sirhan was hypnoprogrammed, that he was not in any voluntary state of mind with respect to this killing, but that, in fact, his whole role was to be a distraction. So he wasn't a Manchurian candidate in that sort of like colloquial sense that he was there to kill the senator. He was there really to cause a distraction so that in the period of time in which the shots were fired, the real assassin could kill Bob Kennedy. Now, Dan Brown's work is very extensive. He was able to bring back to memory through a process not just of hypnotism, but a process of what he calls free recall, where he's fully conscious. But by asking key protocol questions, he's able to elicit events that have not been recollected before. And while Sirhan does not remember all of the events that took place in the pantry at the time of the shooting, he does remember that upon a cue, he was to, and he did, take his position in a shooting style as he had been in the Corina police pistol range that afternoon. He had been at the range that afternoon. He was to take that same position, and what was in his head, and this is where the memory implantation comes in, was he was seeing a target that he saw at the pistol range, and that was what he was told to do. He was told to utter an epithet, take that position, and then just fire. And he was, of course, overpowered, as I said, after the second shot. So one has to read. I'm giving you a summary of all this evidence, but one has to read in detail the work that was done forensically, and by Dr. Brown. So we have those elements, but then, in my view, worse than all of this is the fact that we've uncovered a fraud that was committed on the court at the time of the trial, and that fraud was the substitution of ballistics evidence for real ballistics evidence. There was one bullet that lodged in Senator Kennedy's neck. That bullet was removed by the medical examiner. He marked on the base of the bullet, TN, his name is Thomas Noguchi, he marked on the base of the bullet TN-31. That was the bullet he withdrew, he extracted. When he testified before the grand jury and they showed him the neck bullet, he said, yes, this is, and he looked at the base, he said, this is the bullet I removed. When he testified before the Board of Supervisors, he did the same thing. There was appointed in 1975 a commission under Judge Wenke, Robert Wenke, for the purpose of reexamining the ballistics evidence. Tom Noguchi was not called before that panel, so he wasn't asked to identify the bullet. But
Mr. Pepper, I'm going to ask you to hold on a second. I know we're right in the middle of this story about this new magic bullet, but hold on. We need to take a break. When we come back, we'll pick up that. And also, I'll ask you about these 13 shots. If there were 13 shots, where did all the other bullets go? Stay with us, everyone. We're talking about Sirhan Sirhan and whether he might be an innocent patsy here on Coast to Coast AM. That's a fun tune called Aliens Exist. Not sure if you heard that one before, but a lot of people have. It's from an album released in 1999 called Enema of the State, a huge hit, sold about 15 million copies, a critical hit as well from the band Blink-182. The guy who wrote that song, Tom DeLonge, joins me about 25 minutes from now and for the rest of the evening to talk about all things paranormal. For the moment, we're talking with William Pepper about Sirhan Sirhan, his client who was convicted in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, but some amazing new evidence has surfaced. We'll get back into that conversation about this mystery bullet taken from Robert Kennedy's neck right after this on Coast to Coast AM. My guest is William Pepper talking about the case against Sirhan Sirhan. Before the break, we were discussing this bullet pulled out of Robert Kennedy's neck by the coroner, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, and it was labeled TN-31. Mr. Pepper, what happened, though, when this exhibit got to court?
Well, I mean, I think everyone assumed, defense counsel, I suppose, although there were always questions by people who looked at the ballistics evidence, and there's always been a lot of questioning about the actual ballistic evidence in court. One of the investigators early for Sirhan, Miss Mangan, has contributed greatly to the to that skepticism. What we found, I was able to find a document, which is called an inventory. It was prepared by Patrick Garland, who was the administrator of this Wenke Commission I mentioned. It was a commission formed under Judge Wenke in 1975, and they had seven experts who were to examine all aspects of the ballistic evidence and refire the gun, see if they could match test bullets from Sirhan's guns with any of the bullets who had been recovered from victims. There were a number of other victims who were just wounded in various places by the bullets that were flying around and careening around the room. The bullet introduced at the trial was as the neck bullet was Exhibit 47, State's Exhibit, People's Exhibit 47. Garland's job was to get all the ballistics evidence from the trial court clerk and have it available for the experts to examine, to go over. And as he received the evidence from the court clerk, he prepared this inventory. And when it came to People's Exhibit 47, he noted that the bullet he received had the characteristic, had markings on the base of DWTN, not TN-31. Now, Dwayne Wilfer was the criminalist, the chief criminalist of the Los Angeles Police Department, and he was in charge of the ballistics evidence. And so that DW related quite clearly to Dwayne Wilfer. When I saw that marking, the light went on. Wait a minute. This was DWTN, not TN-31. And the trial court clerk just passed the evidence that was there and it was listed as people's evidence. He just passed it on to Garland. He wasn't trying to cover anything up or falsify. He was just doing his job, I'm sure. So that indicated very clearly to me that another bullet had been substituted for TN-31, but it gets worse. Around the time of the trial, in judge's chambers, the assistant district attorney, Pitt, said, Your Honor, we don't have a foundation for some of our ballistics evidence. He conceded this to the court. Defense counsel, Grant Cooper, immediately piped up and said, well, don't worry about that. We'll stipulate that all of the ballistics evidence is as you say it is.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. He just offered that stipulation. So that, without ever having test-fired the gun himself or his defense team, done any kind of analysis, without having inspected the alleged test-firing by the state and by Wolfer, without any of that defense examination, he just stipulated that all the evidence would be what the state says it was. So there would be no question about it. Then we get into the trial, and of course the ballistics evidence is admitted, as the state says what it was, and the court hears that. And when Tom Noguchi, the medical examiner, is called to the stand, this time he's never asked to identify that neck bullet that he removed. And that always appeared suspicious. Well, why wouldn't you ask? He was the one who extracted the bullet for chain of custody purposes. At least you start with the medical examiner who took the bullet out, marked it, and then turned it over to the police. Neither defense nor the prosecution raised any issues with respect to that neck bullet and identification of it with respect to Tom Noguchi's testimony. Now, what's that all about? I'll tell you what that's about. Defense counsel Cooper was under a pending indictment. He had been indicted for illegally possessing grand jury minutes in another case, the Friars Club case, out in Los Angeles, and they held that indictment over him. And it's my view that he threw the case because of this. We have listed a number of what we call Strickland violations. The Strickland violations relate to the effective assistance of counsel. We've listed a number of glaring instances where defense counsel rendered ineffective assistance. So it's in violation of the of Sirhan's Sixth Amendment rights. So this is what we think happened. When the trial was over, defense counsel made no effort, by the way, during the trial to try to defend Sirhan. He, from the beginning, said, you know, you're guilty, you've done it, we're just going to try and save your life, and we're not going to question the state's evidence, and this is the best thing for us to do. Well, of course, the jury found him guilty on the basis of what they saw and heard, and did not hear an adequate defense. And they not only found him guilty, but they sentenced him to death. So Cooper not only didn't defend him properly, but he even lost the abbreviated effort to save his life at the end of the day. So this made it very clear to us that a bullet marked DWTN was substituted for TN-31.
Is there anything about the bullet that makes it to point more at Sirhan than the actual bullet?
Well, no, absolutely not. Supposedly, Wolfer said that bullet, People's Exhibit 47, he was able to match to Sirhan's gun. Well, of course, when the Wenke panel, experts did their testing of Sirhan's gun, they couldn't match the Sirhan's gun to what had been introduced as evidence as DWTN, as People's 47. They couldn't match that at all. They also couldn't match a bullet that was in one of the victims, Ira Goldstein. It was People's Exhibit 52. They couldn't match that to Sirhan's gun, and they couldn't match bullet that hit Bill Weisel, another victim, to Sirhan's gun. But what they did find was that those three bullets, the one in the senator's neck, and the one that hit Goldstein, and the one that hit Weisel, that they came from the same gun, though not Sirhan's gun. Now, what does that mean? Well, somehow there was another gun that was brought into the frame, and it was also a .22 caliber pistol. And supposedly, Wolfer says he brought it on for some audio sound measurement purposes because he couldn't get hands on the original gun. It was with a grand jury, which is a lot of nonsense. Court would have given it to him if he just asked for a motion, brought a motion in to get it. He could have gotten it, but he said, no, he couldn't. So he brought in this gun that was another gun that they took from the police inventory, and it was H16802 was the serial number of that gun. And our strong suspicion is that the three bullets that were introduced as Exhibit 47, the neck bullet, 52 Goldstein, 54 Weisel, that those three bullets, in fact, came from that second gun, and that they were the ones that were substituted. There was an envelope with three additional bullets. It was Exhibit 55, and that envelope was noted that those three bullets came from H16802. And Wolfer said, no, he made a mistake. he mislabeled that envelope. But we think he didn't make a mistake, and that was the proper label. So what we have then is a situation where there was a substitution of bullets into evidence that were not bullets that were recovered at the crime scene, and in case of Goldstein in the hospital, that is the fraud that was committed upon the court. The court heard that People's Exhibit 47, the neck bullet in Senator Kennedy, was matched to Sirhan's gun. And when they heard that, of course, that, and defense doesn't object to it, and there's no effort to show that this was not the real bullet that was taken from the senator's neck, the judge and jury just heard this false evidence. That's a fraud on the court. Fraud on the court, that whole conviction should be set aside. And when you have a fraud of that sort on the court, the conviction should be set aside, and the state then has the obligation to set this man free or to retry him. That's what happens. That's the law.
Tell me this, given the politics of the situation and the emotion, I mean, it's like tearing a scab off a wound that hasn't healed. What are your chances, no matter how strong your case is? What do you think your chances are?
I think you're quite right in these political cases, and I've been through one with Dr. King. And in these cases, it's very, very difficult, no matter how strong the evidence is. We think that the criminal justice system is really on trial. The evidence in this case is so now, it's emerged to be so strong of this man's actual innocence that the system itself is on trial here. I think we have a difficult uphill fight. We always do in these kinds of political cases, but I think we're determined to take it on. And I can't believe that at least we will not receive an evidentiary hearing where all this can be brought out. The state should not want an evidentiary hearing, frankly.
If there were 13 shots fired, where did all the bullets go? Aren't there some holes somewhere that somebody should have seen? Aren't there some witnesses who should say, hey, I was standing right there, I saw somebody come from behind him and shoot?
Well, all of the above. I mean, there were other people were injured as a result of the shooting that was going on there. Bullet holes were seen and noted as being seen. We go through this as well in doors. At one end of the pantry, those doors were taken off and eventually were destroyed. They disappeared. It was denied there were bullets there, but even one of the witnesses who saw the bullet there and gave a declaration as a former FBI agent, he knew bullets when he saw them, and he said there were bullets in those doors. There were ceiling tiles that were hit by at least one bullet. That bullet was never recovered. So, I mean, I think the answer to your question is that there were bullets all over the place. A number of them were visible in terms of the particularly those doors, and they disappeared. And then there were bullets taken from victims like Mr. Goldstein and Mr. Weisel and and identified, marked into, as it turns out, incorrectly into evidence.
I guess the big question is, so if Sirhan didn't do it, who did? Who could do this? Who could hypnoprogram the guy? Who could manipulate the evidence? Who could threaten his defense attorney and hold that other case over his head? Who could manage all this stuff? Do you want to say?
Well, I mean, it's obviously not down to us to solve the assassination of Bob Kennedy. And that's not really our job. That's the job of the police and the law enforcement authorities. I didn't take this case lightly. I ran Bob Kennedy's campaign in Westchester County. I was his citizens chairman when he ran for the Senate in New York in 1964. So as I knew Martin King that last year of his life, I knew Bob Kennedy during that campaign. I didn't know him. I didn't know the Bob Kennedy who was running in 1968, although he had approached me about working on his presidential campaign and helping him. I'd had it when they assassinated Martin. I thought, that's it. I'm through with this sort of with these sort of politics and political cases. And so I didn't. I was so discouraged with that assassination that I didn't know Bob, the senator whom they killed. But I have a strong emotional reason for wanting to see the case solved. I think we have an unsolved murder, and I believe that that's what's fleshing out here, and that's going to make a lot of people very nervous. In terms of hypnoprogramming, we've put in a massive declaration by Professor Alan Shefflin, who is a leading expert on this area of work, probably in the world. And Shefflin says, of course, that the Central Intelligence Agency has been involved in mind control and hypnoprogramming efforts going back into the late 50s. And he documents pretty clearly a whole history of the agency's involvement in that. Now, that doesn't mean that one or another of the psychiatrists whom they use could not have been hired by some people who wanted Bob Kennedy dead. I think probably the same forces in the society who were behind his brother's killing feared Bob Kennedy because he was taking many of the same positions and wanting to implement them, and also threatening to reopen the investigation of the assassination of the president in 1963. And I think that he had a number of very serious enemies and very powerful enemies with whom he was going to have to deal.
William, very quickly, we've got about a minute or so left. I want to ask you about your client, how much interaction you've had with him, what his state of mind is. I seem to remember him saying and admitting that he did it, and I wonder if he still says that today.
No. He was told by everyone around him that he did it. He was there with a gun. He was firing a gun. So he thought he must have done it. And he did say that. Yes, he did. But that was his belief. Now when he has long since, when he has realized what happened and he's seen a lot of the evidence, even though he doesn't remember very specific events that took place in the pantry, except for the woman who was controlling him, and he does remember her and what she looked like and what she did and so forth. But he's certainly his mental state is fine. He's hopeful. I think he's optimistic because of this new evidence and our new filing. But we just have to see. He's lucid. I think he'd be he's in good shape. I think we're concerned about his safety. I have to say that because if something happens to him, the whole case goes away. So we are concerned. And we have been since I've become involved in the case. We've been concerned about his safety.
What do you have a date of when you might get a hearing or a decision on a hearing?
The state has been given was given 60 days to respond to our last reply, and that they have to come back around February 3rd, I believe it is. We will ask for an opportunity to do a sur rebuttal, they call it, and the court may or may not give us that opportunity. But I would say we're going to have some sort of a ruling pretty early in the new year.
Okay. William Pepper, thank you very much for joining us. Fascinating account there. I hope you'll come back and give us an update as new developments warrant it. Appreciate you being on the program. Coming up, Tom DeLonge of Blink 182 to talk about strange times. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM.